Welcome to the Opium Den. I'm Daniel Williams, and it is April 22nd, 2009. I'm getting ready to call my interview guest this evening. Martin A. Lee is his name. And Martin is a fairly well-known activist. And in 1986, he co-founded FAIR, F-A-I-R, which stands for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. So Martin's also written several books, and the one that we're going to be speaking with him tonight is a book he wrote called Acid Dreams. This continues our LSD theme for our series of interviews. And Acid Dreams is a very chilling and accurate account of the CIA's use of LSD for mind control programs. So we're getting ready to place the call to Martin, and we'll get him on the line and get going. Love that sound. So hang with us, and it's ringing.
Hello,
Martin.
Yeah.
Daniel Williams, how are you?
Hi, Daniel. Hold on. Let me just close my door. Hold on.
Sure.
Okay. Good.
Y'all comfortable now?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, good.
Where are you calling from, Florida?
Yeah, I'm calling from Bonita Springs, Florida.
Where is that?
That's pretty far south on the west coast. We're just about 10 miles north of Naples and 15 miles south of Fort Myers.
Uh-huh. Okay, yeah, I don't know that area too well.
It's a real pretty part of the country. And you're in California, correct?
Yep, northern California.
Oh, that's my favorite part of California. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for sitting with us in the Opium Den tonight. And,
sure.
At the top of the show, I introduced you and gave a brief bio. But And I told everybody that we want to talk about your book, Acid Dreams. So what I'd like to start out with asking you how you got involved with writing that book.
I got involved in writing Acid Dreams initially in the late 1970s. I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, working with an organization called the Assassination Information Bureau, which had moved to Washington to assist the House Select Committee on Assassinations. This was a congressional probe that was reinvestigating the murders of President John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And there was certain aspects of particularly the Kennedy case that overlapped with the CIA's behavior control and mind control experiments, in that the same person, a CIA agent named Sheffield Edwards, who was involved in putting together the mafia and this, basically recruiting mafia hitmen to kill Fidel Castro, which obviously they didn't succeed, but that same person, Sheffield Edwards, was the head of a unit within the CIA called the Office of Security, which was really the first unit within the CIA to investigate LSD for espionage purposes. And because the thought was that the mafia plots against Castro may have had something to do, ultimately, with the Kennedy assassination, that led me into investigating as much as I could about Sheffield Edwards, and one aspect of that, of course, was the early experiments with LSD. So that's basically how I got into it, and then from there, the LSD story, particularly the CIA LSD story, took on a life of its own for me, and I got much more involved with that in terms of researching than I did with the Kennedy assassination at that point.
Now, did you come across this information accidentally? Obviously, you weren't looking for that, but did you just come across it and then go, "Eureka, this could be an interesting subject"?
No, there was an attorney in Washington, D.C. at the time who knew about Edwards, Sheffield Edwards, and his link to the mafia plots, the CIA mafia plots against Castro. And I don't exactly recall how it came out that Edwards was also linked to LSD experiments, but that was the word around Washington, D.C., at least among certain circles. So this attorney was interested in finding out more about this, so he asked me to research that, and I ended up looking at nearly 10,000 pages of once classified CIA documents, and ultimately looked at documents from other U.S. government agencies as well, trying to figure out really what was going on with the U.S. government and LSD in the Cold War years.
Now, was all this information, been declassified and available, or did you have to file any type of freedom information briefs to get access to more information, or was everything that you needed available to you?
Initially, the material was being released on a weekly basis by the CIA as a result of the freedom of information request instigated by John Marks, another researcher. Afterwards, I ended up doing a lot of research involving FOIA requests on my own, both to the CIA and other agencies. And so basically it was a combination of the two, but initially that had been started by another researcher, and the CIA decided to make this information available because there was so much material. On a weekly basis, they would release it to reporters who could gather at one particular location in Virginia and look through this material for an afternoon. And every week there'd be new information. I mean, you have to realize when you're talking about 10,000 pages of material, most of it is just garbage. It's not interesting. But there were gems in there. And then if one was patient and would go through it carefully, one would find a lot of interesting information, shocking information, actually, that not just pertaining to the CIA's experimentation and ultimately its operational use of LSD, but with other drugs and other behavior control techniques as well.
Well, tell us how the CIA became interested in LSD and how their programs developed from there.
Well, there's two versions of that story. One is kind of the official version, where the U.S. government claims that basically it was responding to what it thought were Soviet moves in this area. The CIA feared that the Soviet Union, that other communist countries may be involved with LSD and other mind control techniques. Therefore, the CIA had to look into it as well. Actually, the once classified documents contradict that. It's very clear that the United States government was interested in this area in and of itself, not because of something they feared the Soviets or the communists might be doing. They were into it before the Soviets were. And they looked at this as not just a defensive probe, but something that ultimately would have offensive applications, something they could use in the field in covert operations in a cloak or dagger context. And they were very excited in particular about LSD, which they thought at the time, remember, we have to look back now, this is 1951 when they were initially looking at it. They thought this was going to be the most amazing thing for them. They thought this was going to revolutionize the intelligence trade because LSD was a drug that was so powerful. It was also odorless and colorless and tasteless and therefore very difficult to detect if one had it slipped into their drink or their applied on a cigarette or put in food or something. If it was given to someone surreptitiously, targeted at someone who was an unwitting subject, it would be very difficult for that person to know that they've been given a drug until perhaps the experience came on, until the drug took effect. And in that case, most people really had no idea what LSD was all about. No one really knew about the drug in the early 1950s. So a person might not even have known that they had been given a drug, and they might just think they're going crazy or something like that. But the CIA thought that they could gain an advantage over a person if they would give it to them surreptitiously in this way.
So how did they go about testing, and who ran the program inside? I guess it would be the OSS at that point. Who was responsible for running the program and keeping it on track, so to speak?
Well, you're right when you mentioned the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. That's the forerunner of the CIA. The OSS was around during World War II. And the OSS started a search for a truth drug, an interrogation weapon, basically a truth serum that they could give to an enemy agent or someone they wanted to elicit information from that might not be cooperative, and that if they gave him this drug, sort of magically the information would spill out. That's what the OSS was hoping to achieve. They looked at a lot of different things. Ironically, they decided that marijuana, of all things, was, or a drug very closely related to marijuana, was the most ideal speech-inducing drug that they could come up with. That didn't work all the time. So the CIA picked up where the OSS left off, the CIA, after World War II. It's formed in 1947. And they resumed that secret search for a truth drug. They also looked at marijuana again to check up what had been done before. They tested a lot of different drugs, a combination of various drugs. And ultimately they found that LSD, when all else failed, was sometimes effective in dislodging information from an unwilling subject. So they used it initially, or I should say overall the initial focus of the LSD research that the CIA was conducting in the 1950s, the initial focus was on interrogation. But ultimately from there it branched out and they used LSD in an operational context, not just for interrogation purposes, but also to as a discrediting agent. The idea if they could get it into somebody without them knowing, that person would liable to make a fool of themselves if they were about to give a speech, for example, if it was an enemy politician, someone in another country they didn't like, and they wanted to destabilize that government and get rid of that leader. If they could slip some LSD into their drink before they were about to give a speech, the person who had gotten it would be more likely to make a fool of himself. So as a discrediting agent was another example of how the CIA would use LSD.
Now, in your book, Acid Dreams, which I recommend everyone read, it's an excellent story on how this all came about. But you had mentioned that it appears that the CIA both covertly and overtly enlisted members of the psychiatric community to help provide them data and information on LSD and made it available to them. If that's true, do you believe that those who were, you know, overtly aware of the CIA, do you think they played along just to allow themselves to do the research in LSD?
I think there was a variety of motives that played into it. Again, if we sort of reel back the tape and go back, if we can imagine ourselves back in the early 1950s, first off, although there was some serious interest in LSD within the scientific community as a whole, as a research tool principally to research schizophrenia, to research abnormal states of human consciousness, or to research basically how the mind worked, there wasn't a lot of money for that type of research. And all of a sudden you had these grants coming out from these foundations, which the CIA was secretly controlling these fronts. Sometimes the researchers didn't know ultimately what the real source of the money was, and they would just, they'd be very happy to get money to do their research. Sometimes the researchers were privy to the fact that the CIA, or later on the U.S. Army, was also financing studies like this. People that knew the real source, again, a variety of motives. They may have been just wanting to do their bit to help their country, during the Cold War. There was a lot of paranoia about what the Soviet Union might be up to. It was seen as a potentially a life and death struggle, the superpower face-off. And the CIA didn't carry the same kind of stigma it does in society today with the revelations of torture and so forth. So people were just more than happy, basically, to do this research. They were getting money in situations where otherwise they may not have had funds. And those that understood where the money was coming from, they were happy to do it because they thought they were doing a patriotic service, ultimately. I'm not trying to excuse what someone did. I'm just trying to relate what their perceptions were at the time.
Now, didn't the CIA conduct their own, like, unofficial tests by giving it to agents or actually requiring agents to take it and then would give it to agents unwittingly? I mean, they kind of did their own in-house research, correct?
Yeah, there were basically two tracks to it. There was the in-house research, which I'll describe in a moment, but then you had the going outside to contract researchers, where they'd give money for grants and so forth. Because these are the experts, ultimately, the scientists out there, or the handful that are actually already working with LSD and mescaline and other hallucinogenic drugs. The CIA naturally turned to them because they're more likely to know something about these drugs. And the CIA intuited that LSD had tremendous potential as a cloak and dagger weapon. You know, initially, they didn't really know quite how to use it. They sensed that maybe it could be used for interrogation, so forth and so on. But they wanted to know a lot of questions about the drug. They want to have answered. Was it fatal? Could you give someone an overdose? What would happen if you mix it with this and that? Was it an antidote to it? These sorts of legitimate kinds of scientific or medical questions, they often turn to people on the outside of the intelligence community. At the same time, parallel to this research, there was the in-house research that you just mentioned, where it got pretty funky because, you know, the CIA had a different idea ultimately about what they wanted to do with the drug than the scientists on the outside. Scientists on the outside were not necessarily thinking in terms of giving it to people surreptitiously to blow their minds. They're trying to get information about how the mind worked generally. And the CIA had a different purpose. They were not interested in pure scientific knowledge per se. They were interested in something that could be applied in the field that could facilitate the objectives of a covert operation that reflected the foreign policy that was being set by the U.S. government. And that meant targeting enemies, targeting people in the real world in order to either gain information or influence a political process in another country and so forth. But in order to know how LSD would affect someone if they received it unwittingly, if they weren't told ahead of time that they were getting the drug, if they had no idea what the drug was, that's not something generally they can go outside of the CIA to find out. They couldn't ask a scientist to do that. So they did this research themselves. When I say they, I mean principally two units within the CIA. There actually were several units in the CIA that were experimenting with LSD or interested in LSD. But the two that I learned most about, that it seems most likely were doing the lion's share of the work for the CIA, was the Office of Security, which we talked about a little bit earlier, and the Technical Services Staff. These were two units in the CIA. They had two different purposes. The Office of Security, as the name implies, was involved in missions of security. I mean, basically defensive, protecting the United States. This involved interrogation because they were concerned about enemy agents. They were concerned about threats. They wanted to get information about what was afoot, what was brewing, what the enemy spies were trying to do. So they would use LSD basically for interrogation purposes. That was the Office of Security. But the Technical Services Staff, whose mission was to provide support for covert operations in the field, in other words, when the CIA is meddling in another country, whether it's trying to influence the results of an election or neutralize a charismatic politician in the third world who's, let's say, a little bit too independent for the taste of the Dulles brothers, Alan and John, CIA and State Department chiefs, respectively, then the technical services would be asked to provide things, technical things like poison pens, you know, the kind of get smart stuff we see in TV spy scenarios and so forth, all that sort of stuff. But it could be technical support of any kind for information. It might be like a special airbag for a plane flight. Who knows? Whatever. But part of that meant supplying chemicals, in particular LSD, to be used operationally in the field against certain targets. And the technical service staff, when given that responsibility, decided that LSD was just had too much potential to ignore. And they actually thought that the guys at the Office of Security, and there were actually a rivalry between these two groups and a lot of tension, and the Office of Security ended up spying on the Technical Services staff at one point because they were sort of jealous of the fact that the security people got into it first, LSD, looking at it for interrogation purposes, and then the Technical Services people, a few years later, they start getting into it, and they were not restricted just to interrogation, but they're looking at it for all sorts of different possibilities. Very imaginative in certain ways and scary and ugly, but it ultimately meant that technical services had to find out beforehand what might happen if they used it in this operational context surreptitiously. They couldn't just go out and do it. They had to they needed predictability. They needed some certainty. They had a goal, they had a mission, they had a target, and they wanted a specific result. Ultimately, that was problematic with LSD because it doesn't always didn't always yield predictable results. But particularly when they're just sort of giving it to a person, the person just going on after it, doing whatever they're doing, it might not. You know, it could get a little dicey in terms of that sort of square mindset, predictable mindset that the CIA was into. But ultimately, what the CIA did, they worked their way up step by step to the point where they're actually targeting random civilians, so random American citizens, slipping them LSD to see what would happen. And that started when the CIA agents themselves within technical service started springing in on each other. We're talking about a unit that only has about a dozen people doing all sorts of things, a bunch of whiz kids, whiz bang stuff they're doing. And a guy named Sidney Gottlieb, who was a chemist by training, he sort of seized the reins on the LSD experiments and became ultimately the head of the technical service staff. And one thing that they did was they would give it to each other to kind of figure out, well, what does LSD do? And if they're going to understand what they can do with it as spies, they had to understand what the experience was like. So they took it among themselves, and then they started springing it on each other without telling each other, because, again, they were working their way up to the point where they would just target people unwittingly, randomly. And then, basically, they worked. They hired we can get into it, of course, with George Hunter White. He was a high-ranking official of the Federal Narcotics Bureau, actually, supposedly involved in keeping drugs out of circulation, at least by day, by night, was running an operation in a CIA safe house in New York City that was actually decorated as a bordello, a whorehouse. And White was working with prostitutes who he had hired. These were prostitutes who were often addicted to drugs, addicted to heroin and so forth. And White was able to control them as this narcotics honcho. And he had them lure their customers from bars back to the CIA safe house. These are people that would think they were going to make it with the prostitute. And White and his coterie would watch behind two-way mirrors while these women would slip LSD into the drinks of their customers. And so they had this whole operation. The problem is,
there's lots of problems.
Drinking, then they run out in the middle of the night. You never know what happened to them. It's who knows.
It wasn't a controlled experiment.
It's certainly not a controlled experiment, as anyone who's taken LSD knows or had that experience. The idea of never having had it before and then just getting it launched on you without any forewarning or without wanting to have the experience is not a very, it can make for some very, very frightening interludes and episodes and a very, not a good way to use, that's an abuse of the drug, we could say. And ultimately, this is what the CIA was doing in order to gain information as to how to use LSD as a covert weapon. The other thing they were doing in these safe houses, there were a lot of things they were doing there, but they were exploring how to use sexuality in covert operations. If you got somebody you want to get information from, if you can get a whore to go to bed with them and who's trained in eliciting information, well, there's all sorts of questions they're trying to figure out, like when's the best time to get information, before or after sex, during sex. There's all sorts of things that the CIA was interested in terms of sex espionage, if you will.
Right.
It was sex, drugs, and I don't know about rock and roll, but the first two at the safe house. And the most amazing thing is this guy White was he was at one point in line to succeed Harry Anslinger as head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. That never happened because White was such a cowboy. He was so out of control in some ways that by the time Anslinger left in 1962, Anslinger, by the way, was privy to all that I just described.
Really?
I may not ever need to. He was privy to the fact that White was running an operation for the CIA where they were surreptitiously dosing people with LSD. How much Anslinger exactly knew about their operation, I don't know. White had quite a scene going there.
And, well, what... What dose level were they giving these Johns? Were they working on various dose levels to see what it would work, or did they just give everybody 300 micrograms and blow their brains out?
I mean, keep in mind that George Hunter White, who's overseeing this, is not a scientist, and I'm sure he was given the material by the CIA, and they're told, you know, with a little thing, how to squirt something in a drink so you couldn't see it was being done if you had it in your hand. And like with a cigarette lighter, you lean over the drink and you look like you're hitting the cigarette lighter, but it's actually dropping a drink in your drink. You know, the other person's drink. I mean, this sort of stuff is also, again, these gadgets and techniques are being studied. So it's a pretty crazy scene. And the other thing is, it's a place where the CIA brought people, because it was a CIA safe house. They, you know, if there was some Russian official at the United Nations that they thought they could turn, you know, so they get them down in the safe house, they put these women on them, they give them, you know, some vodka, maybe some spike fly. You know, it's a place that the CIA can do all sorts of things. Bags of money were passed to people, you know, in these safe houses. So all kinds of stuff's going on. But certainly the most scandalous is what George Hunter White was doing at the behest of the CIA with LSD.
Now, I want to get into Dr. Frank Olson here in a minute, but I read your book a while ago, and I didn't read it completely again before tonight, but is there any evidence, is there any documentation where LSD was actually employed in the field against our perceived or real enemies?
Yes, there was. There was keep in mind that the documents that were released pertaining to Operation MK Ultra, which was the umbrella project run by the Technical Service Staff, 149 different sub-projects, or I should say 149 different projects or experiments that are being run under this one umbrella, of which maybe 30% of that had to do with drugs, and of that maybe a third of it had to do with LSD in particular, just to give you a scope of this, you know, looking at hypnosis, sleep deprivation, electroshock, subliminal manipulation technique, any kind of behavior control experiment. So when they had released these memos from MKUltra, it was mainly financial records. And they keep a lot of paper there, and so it was basically records of the grants and things like that. If they give money to somebody, they want to have to keep them, you know, what's the results? What did they learn? So they had memorandum about these things, but there's not specifically information that pertains to operational uses, except in a very small number of documents. And that was when the Office of Security was spying on technical services, because they were both jealous and concerned, because, you know, there were some crazy things that technical services were doing. We just talked about the safe house stuff in New York with George Hunter White. And there was sort of a whiff of that around, because security was spying on their own, you know, on the CIA, on their own, on a company man, you know. And those memos about what they found are very revealing. Very revealing, and it refers to the fact that Gottlieb went to Africa at one point in the early 60s with LSD with him, and they were going to target a third world politician, a leader in Africa, that probably linked to the non-aligned movement, which was something that the U.S. government didn't like. And, you know, there was significant evidence of CIA involvement in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in Congo. So, you know, they had stuff going on. And I mean, trying to character assassinate an enemy or a target with LSD is something that probably the CIA would prefer to do, rather than necessarily killing someone. You know, if you can get away with just sort of neutralizing by making them look stupid, it's probably a less risky, what can you say? You know, a less intense thing to do than actually kill someone. So it might have been that Lumumba was the target, but they don't identify who the target is in these documents. Those names are deleted. It's known that Gamal Abdel Nasser, the leader of Egypt in the 50s and early, basically from mid-50s, mid-60s, who was very outspoken. At one point, Egypt sort of was more tilting to the Soviets. And he was targeted for an LSD, a surprise LSD attack, but it apparently never came off. We know that Castro was in Cuba was being targeted not just with LSD, but with assassination devices. So, yes, you could say that this was going on. There was also, again, some of the security records for interrogation, which is something they were doing in the field in other countries, not just in the United States, but they were using LSD for quote-unquote unorthodox interrogations. They were using other drugs as well, but LSD was kind of the last resort. So there's references to these operations. There's also records of interrogations in the field. Some of these are quite startling. You know, it's right now we're hearing about the CIA torture and whatnot, that the Obama administration just released some records about that. You go back and look at the drug, I don't want to say experiments, the use of different drugs and different behavior modification techniques by CIA special interrogation teams, they call them, run by the Office of Security, dispatched to places throughout the world as and when necessary. When you had somebody you just couldn't crack and you've tried everything and they've been, you know, all right, then they put the LSD on them, you know. This is what they were doing.
When all else fails, give him some acid.
Sort of. It's not something they would generally do as a first resort. They would try just talking to, you know, sometimes different things work.
Right.
They found that basically softer approaches tended to work. But the way they were doing this with LSD, ultimately found it's not something you just give a person and they spill the beans. That's what they kind of thought initially. They thought, or they hoped. That was their idea of a truth serum they were fixated on for many years. But they realized that if you gave a person LSD who you wanted to get information from, they were resisting you. They didn't know they'd been given a drug. Again, odorless, colorless, tasteless. They just smoked a cigarette and an hour later, they're feeling really weird, kind of sick, and then the hallucinations start to come on, and they start to flip out because they're in this terrible situation. You know, they're prisoners, and then the CIA guy moves in there and says, you know, we're going to keep you this way forever unless you talk to us. That's what they would do. They use it as a psychological pressure technique, and that sometimes would make a person crack and get them to talk when they weren't talking before. Now, again, how accurate the information is, that's another question. But sometimes this did work, at least in terms of getting a person to talk who was otherwise uncooperative. The Office of Security did refer to LSD with a particular code name, and the document was called P1, P as in Paul, -1. A P1 operation was an LSD interrogation. And so, yeah, this is a long, drawn-out answer to your question, pertinent question. Would they actually really use this? I would say yes. There's not tremendous amount of records about this because the CIA does not, as a matter of course, release information about operational. There are documents that deal with operational covert action. You know, they don't do that. The CIA release a lot of things. They generally don't release things about what they actually do in the field until 50 years later or whatever. But there's clear indication that this is being used. I suspect it wasn't being used extensively, but it was being used by the mid-50s for interrogations and by a little bit later, around that time for as a discrediting agent. They were also looking at it for different ways. They looked at it for as a psychological assessments thing, that if they so they would give it to their own recruits in the CIA, people they were going to send out in the field who weren't, not the shirts, but the actual agents, actual spies, and they would give them LSD beforehand as part of their training to see if they'd crack easy. And if someone cracked easy under LSD at headquarters or during the training seminar, then maybe they didn't really have the fortitude and the stuff to do it in the field, because if they got caught, it was always a risk, and they were harshly interrogated or something, or whatever. They didn't want people that would crack easy. So this is a way of checking people out and seeing what they could handle. And this was explicitly discussed in CIA documents, and more than one. It seems this was, for a while, early, mid-50s, used in this way as a personality assessments technique. And there's other examples of how the CIA was considering or possibly using LSD. It wasn't a one-note thing. It wasn't a one-horse cart.
I'm wondering why, with my experience and what generally seems to be the experience of many, why they didn't use MDMA as a truth serum. It seems to be makes people open up and discuss things openly. So,
well, I think they were aware of NDA. because that's something we're close related to MDMA. I think MDMA is made from it, but MDA was what was called the love drug back in the 60s. MDMA, of course, we now call ecstasy or know of as ecstasy. Very closely related, combination of mescaline, amphetamine, and yes, it does have effects of relaxing people, and it has a kind of a psychedelic effect in the sense of it helps people, helps release this sort of stuff in one's consciousness, unconsciousness, I'd say, or just one's personal history, things that are psychologically charged. It has a way of loosening things up so that this stuff comes out, and good for therapeutic purposes in that way. Various doctors have found. But I think one thing about LSD, of course, you get the visual hallucinations, which you don't get with MDMA and with MDMA. And LSD is more powerful, just more potent as a substance. And it had kind of penetrated the scientific zeitgeist. I mean, there was a real buzz about LSD in the scientific community. And very quickly thereafter, this is not long after Hoffman discovered the drug, Dr. Albert Hoffman from Sandoz in Basel, Switzerland, where you and I met, Daniel, I believe. Didn't
That's
we
correct.
Meet there?
Yes, we did.
Yeah. For that wonderful that conference, it's that had beautiful memories for me. But I think
we're going to talk about one of those memories here in a few minutes.
So that's worth thinking to talk about LSD. We can dwell on the CIA and the dark side, and I spoke about this at length at different times at the conference. But there's also so much more, of course, with LSD.
Well, that's what I want to get to. But I, from reading your book, it seems that the CIA experiments pretty much petered out around the time of Dr. Frank Olson and his suicide, I guess, in quotation. So let's finish up the dark side with the story of Dr. Frank Olson, and then we'll get into the lighter, brighter side.
Well, Frank Olson case is a very important one. Frank Olson was an Army biochemist who was working out of Fort Detrick, Maryland, which was the headquarters of the Biological Warfare Research, Testing, and Development Program. And there, again, they were in some weird stuff, if you can imagine, all these weird germs that the CIA and the Army. This is the Fort Detrick was a combined CIA-Army effort, actually. But it was Army Fort. But it wasn't located that far from the CIA, Fort Detrick, Maryland, CIA, Washington, so there was a lot of interchange. And one aspect of that, since the technical service staff was being called upon, apparently, by the United States to provide devices to disseminate germ warfare there in various ways, they had Gottlieb from technical services had contact with Fort Detrick. And one of the things they did at one point was invite some of the Detrick boys that they were involved with consulting and brainstorming for a while. They've been doing it for a number of years. Invite him to a retreat in the backwoods of western Maryland. And this is not something totally unusual. They would go on these retreats now and then. But at this particular retreat after dinner, the after-dinner drink was spiked, some liqueur. And Frank Olson was there, and he had and they weren't told beforehand. This is the point at which the CIA was starting to test it on. They were still keeping it within the kind of the intelligence community, so to speak, within the military. They hadn't gone outside to civilians yet, but they were now starting to spring it on people with that forewarning. It was that step along the way to the actual using of covert operations. And Olson had a terrible experience, and he became quite distraught. And a few weeks later, he ended up plunging out of a hotel window 10 stories to his death in New York City on a cold winter, almost winter night in early December 1953. This caused some problems for the CIA. They actually briefly stopped experimenting with LSD or working with LSD. They kind of put the program on hold. It picked up afterwards, and it did go strong for another 10 years or so. But the lingering questions regarding Olson is, did he jump out of the window or was he pushed? And I, for one, lean to the latter explanation. Olson's son, Eric, their family was compensated. The Olson story, in part, came out 1974, when the Rockefeller Commission, so-called, a commission headed by then-Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, looking into the CIA's family jewels. It was sort of this, things were starting to come out about CIA spying on American citizens, which was a no-no, not part of the charter. It's a foreign intelligence service. A little bit about some drug stuff, various things, some CIA mafia assassination plot. These things were starting to percolate, and different revelations were coming out, and it was a time when things about our government were being exposed, the Pentagon Papers showing that the story about why U.S. got involved in Vietnam was false, and so forth and so on. So things were coming out, in order to kind of head off these investigations, or almost preempt them, the Rockefeller Commission released a report, and it mentioned this Olson case. It was talking about a death that happened two decades earlier. And since that time, they called it a suicide, the Rockefeller part, and they took the CIA to task for recklessly experimenting on somebody who was psychologically unstable or whatever, who ended up killing himself. Kind of reinforce all those old stories about LSD, people jumping out windows and freaking out and killing himself. And indeed, things like that have happened with LSD, and it's not very common, but it does happen sometimes. But I think what Eric Olson, his son, who's very persistent looking into the case and just felt something was very fishy about the official explanation, the belated official explanation. He had the body dug up by New York judge ruled that it should be forensically examined. And the forensic examiner concluded that Olson had been clubbed. He'd been hit on the head. The wounds consisted with being hit with the club, both on his skull, the way it was fractured, and other bruises he had on his body were not consistent with the fall from a 10-story window. It was consistent with him getting bludgeoned to death and then being pushed out of a window. So I think Eric Olson feels that his father was already somewhat conflicted about the work he was doing in the biological warfare area for the U.S. government, and was having some moral second thoughts about it, so to speak, so he was somewhat anguished about what he was doing or had been doing professionally, and then he got this LSD, and then he really flipped out, and it seemed like he was going to reveal things to get it off his conscience, get it off his chest, and as far as his kind, he was going to become a whistleblower. That's what Eric feels was going on with his father. And if that was the case, that would provide a reason why the CIA would want to silence him, because he was with a couple of CIA agents, in fact, the deputy from technical services, Gottlieb's right-hand man, a man named Robert Lashbrook, was in the hotel room with Olson when he jumped, fell, or was pushed out the window.
He was the club wielder.
That's the implication. Again, we don't know this for sure, but this is what the forensic examiner, I mean, maybe they had someone come, they got their pros. Maybe they wanted their mafia boys come in and do it. I don't know. Maybe they drugged Olson, put him to sleep, then beat the shit out of him and cracked his skull. Who knows? But whatever it is, there's some unanswered questions there.
But his family was compensated and
yes, financially.
Without any admission of guilt by the government, but they did compensate the family quite well.
And there was an apology. There was an apology, but this was basically, the government basically said he took his own life because of something that the government did. And if it's a clever cover story, it's a very clever one, because that's not a totally implausible scenario. And who knows, finally, in the end.
I think we probably know as much as we're going to know.
I think the forensic evidence here is very significant.
Very solid. Okay, well, I'm fucking depressed enough, so let's move into the lighter and brighter side and talk about the second portion of your book, or the latter portion of your book, which talks about the 60s counterculture and how LSD became not maybe a household word, but certainly utilized by millions of young people. So
yeah.
You, in your book, I want to just kind of move right into the Timothy Leary portion of your book, and Timothy Leary, I think, was quoted in your book as saying that if it hadn't been for the CIA, he wouldn't have discovered LSD on his part, because there was all of these deals going on with covert and overt organizations. And he, as well as Ken Kesey, you know, the Merry Pranksters, Acid Test, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, they said that they got their first LSD from these type of program. So Leary said if it hadn't been for the CIA, he wouldn't have gotten where he got himself. So let's talk about Timothy Leary and what you found and what you reported in your book.
Leary said that about a year after he got out of jail. You know, he was in jail for much of the 1970s, either in jail or in exile, and some kind of deal was cut. Where he was able to get out of... I mean, first of all, he was sentenced for marijuana charges,
right,
not for LSD. He was sentenced twice in a very important case, because it ended up overturning the Marijuana Tax Act when it went to the Supreme Court. But ultimately, it gave Nixon the opportunity to ram through the Controlled Substances Act, which is, you know, the
his
law.
His legacy.
But I think Leary was basically being somewhat facetious and tongue-in-cheek when he said that. He speaks a little bit double entendre. He said, I'm all in favor of central intelligence.
Right.
You know, talking about, like, well, does he mean God, or does he mean the CIA, or
right,
both, or none,
right,
or none, or all four possibilities at once? Probably the latter. But, you know, so I don't take it too seriously in terms of what Leary's saying in that way. There are things to say about the CIA and Leary. The CIA was watching Leary. Leary was a relative latecomer to the research scene, we have to realize. He
right,
got into it in 1960, initially,
right,
psilocybin, the mushroom extract. It had been, LSD research had been going on for over a decade already in the United States, around the world. Again, there were 1,000 papers written on the subject, almost 1,000 by that time. There was a lot of very interesting work being done in a lot of different areas of science, and particularly psychiatry, but also just brain science research and some neurochemistry. So Leary comes into a relatively late in the game. He becomes very quickly a convert to psychedelics. The CIA by this time had been also working with LSD for a decade, basically, and by after 10 years of research and 10 years of toying with it and actually using it in the field, the CIA pretty much knew what they could or couldn't do with LSD. I mean, to the extent that one can figure out LSD, which maybe that's a dubious notion, but
yeah,
but they, in terms of their limited purposes of covert warfare, they figured they knew what to do with it and how. It's my sense they understood that it did have some limitations as a espionage weapons, because of its unpredictability, because it's impossible to control absolutely when you're springing it on someone, you know, this sort of thing. But they did use it. But they were also very concerned about, they looked at this as an area of national security. They looked at LSD as a national security substance and something that had very significant implications for national security. So they were in the habit of basically monitoring the research scene, keeping an eye on researchers around the world, sending people to talk to them, finding out the latest stuff. Because remember, if you're involved with LSD research, you may also be involved with researching other drugs. Or maybe they knew some things the CIA didn't know. We're talking about, you know, prominent researchers, cutting-edge research going on in the scientific world.
Oh, yeah, the CIA sought out very prominent folks.
They want to know what's going on. They want to keep up on the cutting edge. They're not necessarily scientists themselves so much within the CIA, but they need to have relationships with scientists. And Leary was he was a psychologist. You can say he's a social scientist, and the CIA was interested in what he did in the same way they're interested in anybody who's of this caliber. He was at Harvard, this prestigious university. But what really got the CIA going on Leary was the fact that Leary had contact with wives of prominent CIA people, Cord Meyer's wife, Mary Meyer. Cord Meyer was a prominent CIA official. Not a small fry, but high up in the hierarchy. And his wife was hanging out with Leary, apparently taking LSD. She was an artist, and Leary was interested in giving it to painters and musicians and so forth. That was one aspect of what he was interested in, LSD's implications for the creative process and so forth. So the CIA kind of, the alarm bells went off. Well, hey, what's going on? And they know that LSD is something that can mess with your mind, and you can use to get information from people. And here is this guy Leary giving it to prominent CIA operatives or officials' wife. You know, this was an area of interest to the CIA. So Leary was under surveillance. It might have been rigorous surveillance, but I think the CIA had their eyes on him for various reasons. But it wasn't like he was working for the CIA or anything like that. That's ridiculous. Kesey, you mentioned him. He got turned on to LSD for the first time through the Veterans Administration, which is part of the U.S. military, which was also conducting extensive LSD research that paralleled, in some ways, eclipsed the CIA's work. The military is looking at or sought to develop a chemical warfare weapon, a psychochemical warfare weapon, madness gas, hallucinogenic gas that they could use in a chemical warfare context to knock people out without killing them. That was the idea, to incapacitate. Anyway, so this was also going on. And so they had all kinds of research with LSD that they were, again, funding outside researchers of the Army, like the CIA was, going to universities and so forth. And the universities were turning to students to gather information about how LSD affects psychic processes and mental processes. And they had, who knows, whatever. They were trying to find out what LSD does to people, because the Army was going to give it to their own soldiers. They want to know, well, what would do these soldiers? So let's find out what did to the students first at Harvard and at Columbia and at Princeton. And we're talking Stanford, the best and the brightest kind of people. And Stanford, was the area where Kesey was. And so the Veterans Administration, as part of the Army stuff, they were looking at LSD also for potentially therapeutic purposes. Because this was being discussed at the time, it was in the zeitgeist in the late 50s. So right. The Veterans Administration, you know, with soldiers who crack and stuff, maybe not to the extent that they do now in Iraq and Afghanistan, but nonetheless, PTSD, post-traumatic stress, these were issues for soldiers. Always been issues for soldiers, for people at war. War does bad things to people in the head, you know. And so they come back and they go to the psychiatric services of the Veterans Administration, and the Veterans Administration wants to know, well, what does this drug do? So they go to, they start giving it to people. They put the word out, a little ad in the local newspaper. You get $50 if you volunteer for this experiment with lysergic acid. And Kesey's and his crowd, they knew about this, and they signed up real quick, and an interesting tale will emerge from that. But so yes, you could say that. But again, this is not some plot on the part of the Army,
I don't buy it.
The counterculture. No. This is. But there's no question what the CIA and the Army was doing helped set in motion a chain of events. It got a certain momentum going. At least one tributary that fed into the stream that became the counterculture. Academic research with LSD was very important. It became part of the popular culture when people like Cary Grant turned on, when Hollywood shrinks started giving them movie stars, and all of a sudden it's in the news. So it spread out in various ways, and various tributaries feed into the counterculture in the 60s, or the LSD subculture, whatever. Certainly the beat writers are tremendously important. Also the academics, the scientific community that's working with LSD, the CIA and the military. Everything that's going on is feeding into what will become the counterculture, but not because it's some kind of weird plot.
No, I don't buy into the fact that
CIA... that's not how I see it, but there's an interesting relationship there that... Again, continues, because imagine if you're some CIA guy that's had your mind blown with LSD in 1955. In 1965, you know, people all over Berkeley and San Francisco are taking the drug. That you thought was the threat to, you know, the national security. All of a sudden, all these people were, you know, wearing crazy outfits, long hair, listening to weird music, doing weird things. You know, just part of this whole youth rebellion that's really emerging just around the time that LSD becomes available on a large-scale way in 1965 from Owsley and other underground chemists. All these things coming together.
Yeah. You're speaking of underground chemists. I had a conversation interview with Nick Sand the other day, and that was very good.
I'm sure he's got an amazing story to tell. when I was working on Acid Genius, I didn't have an opportunity to speak with him because he was underground.
Right.
I did speak at length with his partner Tim Scully, who's a wonderful human being, wonderful man, and he, the two of them, Scully and Sand, were Owsley's acolytes, as it were, and after Owsley semi-retired, Sand and Scully picked up and really were the main source of LSD as a street drug for in the late 60s. I don't think that's an exaggeration to say that.
Nick was our brightest, I think, our brightest chemist, and did a tremendous amount of
well, he continued
work.
Long after the 60s.
He paid
the price, of course, as
right.
well.
He did pay the price, but he's in good spirits, and it was great speaking with him and Usha, his wife. Now, I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Nick and I discussed with Albert Hoffman when my wife and I had the opportunity to visit with Albert and Anita in their Swiss home back in 2003. I sent my LSD section of my book that I wrote. I was able to get it to Albert and hope that he would review it to see if there was anything wrong. And he liked it, and it's a blurb on the book. So we had the opportunity to go and meet, and it was a wonderful experience. But we were talking about Leary, and we talked about a number of things a very long afternoon. And I asked Albert if he, on balance, if he thought that Timothy Leary was good for LSD, or if he screwed the pooch. So that's the question I want to put to you. Do you think that Leary, on balance, did a good thing, or did he screw the pooch?
Well, you know, Leary played obviously a very, very important role. There are other people with whom he shared the stage. Allen Ginsberg played just as if not, you know, important role, and so did Ken Kesey. You know, so it's not just Leary, but he did become equated in mass public consciousness with LSD, probably more so than any other single individual. I'm sorry, what were you going to say, Daniel?
No, when I talk, I speak on college campuses about drugs and drug prohibition, and I was surprised and somewhat saddened that a lot of people, I mean, there's a tremendous interest in hallucinogens on college campuses and generally in that age group. And many people think that Timothy Leary discovered LSD. So I understand all these other folks that you had mentioned, but Timothy Leary seems to stand out in everyone's mind about that. So,
yeah, no, as I said, not only did he not discover it, but he wasn't even he was a latecomer.
Yeah, he came to the party late.
But he was its most ardent convert, mm-hmm. and he the way things played out, he certainly embraced the role of Pied Piper. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I think Leary is a complicated figure. I think he's more complicated than he tends to be portrayed. In part is because he'd be such a media figure, and the media, you know, mass media can be so cardboard. You know, can turn complex characters into such flat sort of characters.
Yeah, one dimensional.
You know, when you're talking about a drug like LSD, you know, nuance is built into the DNA, you know. So, but what's my take on Leary? Well, I think Leary is like that song in the Jefferson Airplane, from the Jefferson Airplane, "One Pill Makes You Larger, One Pill Makes You Small." I think LSD kind of made him larger and small. I mean, first off, it is weird and misleading to portray enlightenment or the best orgasms or personal fulfillment or whatever, surefire transformation in the right direction as something that's embedded in a pill. I think that's a misleading notion. And Leary sometimes seemed like he was doing that because, I'm not saying he wanted to do that, I'm just saying that if you're going to sell it, and that's what he opted to do, that's the small pill, and that salesman. Then you got to make it smaller, in a sense. Then you got to simplify. Then you got to reduce it. And LSD resists reduction. If you really respect it, And I think, but if you want to, if the thing is to sell it, if the thing is to get people to take it, then if that's Leary's chosen role. That's the role he opted for after he got fired from Harvard in, I believe it was June of 1963.
Mm-hmm.
He opted for that role, and that's a role that was in some ways too small for a man like him. Leary was a very prominent young rising star in the world of academic psychology.
You know, absolutely.
He was not a small fry in the academic world. He was at Harvard. Harvard was not just Harvard, but John Kennedy, the new president, came from Harvard. You know, Harvard was all eyes on Harvard.
Right.
And Leary's at Harvard, and then he gets kicked out for reasons that, various reasons that are not necessarily all of his own fault or his own doing. But he goes on this trajectory, and there's no question he liked the media spotlight. He liked the adulation. He liked that kind of thing. But he also... That was a role that is both too big and too small for any single human being. That's what I meant about that. One pill
right.
makes you larger, and
right.
one small makes you. The idea of being the leader, quote unquote, of something like a psychedelic movement is ridiculous. First of all, I don't know if psychedelics were a movement. It was part of a subculture that was tied into various movements or cultural manifestations that were happening, percolating, beginning in the mid-60s and lasting still to this present day in different shapes and forms. The idea that you would lead something like a movement of people taking LSD, that's not really what was going on in the 60s. You know, but so that notion, that's too big a role for any human being. And the role of salesman for Leary, a person who was a complex, exceedingly bright, very charismatic, very quick, and very vulnerable, you know, in some way, you know, and also very flawed. All those things mixed together, that's Timothy Leary. And he was opting to be the salesman, a role too little for him. And he was also opting to be the leader for something, he's opting for a role that was too big for anybody. So that's my take on Timothy Leary. Was it his fault? It's more complicated than that. Yes, in part, I mean, he was a guy that would thumb his nose at authority. You know, this happened to him when he was at West Point, when he was a young man, first he went to West Point. He was always getting in trouble with the authorities. He was sort of an anti-authoritarian figure in that way, and that was his personality. The consequences of what he did are exceedingly significant in terms of helping to bring about a situation where several million people took LSD in the United States by the late 1960s. That was a lot of that was Leary's doing. It wasn't just his doing. There were a lot of factors. It's easy to blame Leary for being irresponsible. Therefore, the government decided to stop all research. Well, that's ridiculous. You know, I mean, look how many irresponsible things that researchers do with respect to tobacco or any other kinds of, and fudging the, scientific data to meet some dictates of a drug. All these things are going on. People aren't being, it doesn't end up like with Leary. I mean,
right.
I think there are a lot of reasons why he was fired and from Harvard, and part of it had to do with his behavior. I don't think he wasn't that concerned that LSD sugar cubes were going around campus and undergraduates were taking it. It's not because of him that was happening, but he was part of people heard about what he was doing on campus and it generated interest, and there were interests on other campuses as well. And, you know, LSD was discussed in Life magazine before Leary ever got into it. So there was some interest already in the culture. People were reading Allen Ginsberg's poems and Kerouac's books and so forth, so that there was already an interest in hallucinogens, already an interest in psychedelics. It's not that Leary just created that interest, but he certainly amplified it by what happened. He was certainly a huge catalyst. But I think it's too easy to blame one person for what happens, good or bad, and when you have such a complicated phenomena as the LSD scene in the 1960s, which overlaps and is interrelated to so many different things going on in the 60s, from the new left to art things and to Silicon Valley, what becomes that. You know, all these things are, LSD's playing into it. So what, are you going to blame Leary for the fact that Steve Jobs took LSD. Well, maybe that's a good thing. Well, you know, it's not theory. It's Steve Jobs, yeah. What he did, who he did, and look what happened. That had more influence in the culture, arguably, than anything Tim Leary did. You know, but so more or less influence. I don't know. I don't like when I hear people teeing off on Leary in terms of research. He was trying to do some very interesting, innovative experiments at Harvard, and with prisoners, with looking at religious experiences. People know about that if they go back and look at the history. You know, and this is legitimate research. Was he playing fast and loose? Yeah, they were having a good time. They were blowing minds. Allen Ginsberg was coming up and talking his ear off. He was meeting through Ginsberg Jack Kerouac and Charlie Mingus, and all these great artists and musicians were coming up and hanging around with Leary. He's loving it, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And this is part of what's happening with LSD at Harvard. So Leary did not play by all the rules that you play by if you're going to stay within, strictly speaking, that role of the researcher. He was that, but he was wearing another hat as well. Was that an irresponsible hat that he was wearing? Well, I don't know. I can see why some people might think so, but do I think so? Is it irresponsible to have given Jack Kerouac psilocybin? I mean, Kerouac had some interesting things he said about it. You know, I mean, it was outside. See, what happened really was one of Leary's colleagues, Richard Alpert, he made homosexual advances toward a graduate student or an undergraduate, so a student at Harvard, and we might have been under the influence of LSD. We might have been, you know, he got involved in a bit of a, and that is a serious issue, and that's a mistake, and that's a kind of a sexual harassment. It can be a little bit weird, that kind of situation. And given the puritanical ethos around homosexuality at the time in American culture, which probably Allen Ginsberg more than anybody was right. doing to break through, just he was trying to break through cannabis prohibition, that scandal was the pretext that Harvard authorities used to not just fire Alpert, but fire Leary. I mean, Leary didn't do that kind of stuff, but they were looking for a pretext to take him out. Now, is that because the CIA was upset about what Leary was doing? Maybe they got on the phone to one of their buddies at Harvard. Who knows? That could have had. I don't rule it out. Certainly, by this time, by the early 1960s, by 1963, when Leary is fired, it's a time when there's a pullback across the board at the Food and Drug Administration and other health bureaucracy agencies, NIMH, NIH, within the U.S. government. They start pulling back drastically on LSD research. Prior to 1962, prior to the early 60s, there was a lot of research that the U.S. government was supporting, not just in terms of brain chemistry and neuroscience, but in terms of therapeutic possibilities of LSD. The U.S. government was very supportive of this. This looked like it was a really interesting area. LSD was being discussed as an adjunct for alcoholism therapy and so forth and so on.
Oh, isn't the gentleman, the guy that started Alcoholics Anonymous, didn't he credit taking LSD?
Yeah. I think, what is it, Wilson is his name? I forget. But yes. No, this was, again, LSD did not have the stigma that it acquired later in the decade. Didn't have that stigma because there were no scandals yet. I mean, this was what was going on. The first LSD scandal was Leary being fired from Harvard.
Right.
And this was at a time, just it coincided with a change in policy internally within the U.S. government, where the research was being drastically cut back, particularly in the therapeutic area. And scientists who had relatively easy access, psychiatrists who had relatively easy access to LSD in 1962, all of a sudden in 1963 did not have easy access. So there was a change of policy, and it coincides also with the fact that by this time the CIA doesn't need to turn to outside researchers to get more information about LSD because it's pretty much thoroughly researched for their purposes after 10 years.
Well, that
so all these things come together that may or may not be feeding into what's changing at this time and what culminates in Leary's being fired.
Well, your assessment of Timothy Leary as a very complex individual pretty much dovetails to what Albert Hoffman told me and what Nick Sand related to me the other day. And I also mentioned, I also pretty much come to that conclusion in my book as well. So I want to take us back to 2006, to the International LSD Symposium, 100th birthday for Albert Hoffman, and the first time that I came across and met you. I went to your talk there, and there was a significant amount of people in there. I think it was maybe 150, a lot of folks coming in to listen.
Is that the one on the CIA's work in the military?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And you were...
That ended up being a little bit weird.
Yeah, well, that's where I'm going. So I'm sitting there, my wife and I are sitting there, and we're just, you know, thoroughly engrossed because, I mean, we had peripheral knowledge of the CIA, but nothing nearly as in-depth as what you were relating to the crowd. And it was a very, very attentive crowd. And you had moved through your lecture, and you were talking about Timothy Leary and his odyssey and how he was finally captured, of all places, in Kabul, Afghanistan. And that you'd mentioned that it was your understanding that his girlfriend at that time was responsible, either wholly or in part, for setting Timothy Leary up to be arrested there in Afghanistan. So then you moved through that, and that was towards the end of your presentation, and then you asked for questions, and obviously everybody wanted to ask you a question. One lady stood up and said, and she took you to task for your accusing Leary's girlfriend at that time of being a double agent and being a part of Leary's capture. And she said, "You don't know because you weren't there, and I was there, and my name is Joanna Harcourt Smith, Leary's girlfriend at the time."
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, that you could have heard a mouse fart in that room, mm-hmm. because when she said that, mm-hmm. I immediately looked at you, and I'm thinking, this is going to be really good or really bad. But as I mentioned to you later, when I spoke to you, I said, you handled that with such class and understanding, and you just deflected her right off the screen, and moved into your final comments. But I
want to
know what was going on in your head, Martin, when she stood up and identified herself. What was your first thought?
I hadn't. What I remember from that seminar was that I wanted to open it up and have it be more interactive, because in the big assembly hall, when they have the panels, people weren't having much of a chance to interact with panelists and with speakers, so I wanted to make it more interactive. So I rather than do a sort of a hour spiel or shtick and just talking and then taking questions,
I said,
you know, throw out a question. If it's in the flow, if it seems right to deal with it, fine. If not, we'll come back to it. So and then this woman comes up there and starts. I thought she was like grandstanding. As I was looking at her, I'm saying, "Oh my God, that's Joanna Leary." And she doesn't, and this is quite a few years later in her prime, and she did. I can't say she's aged that gracefully.
I realized it,
and I'm not surprised, actually. I realized that was her, and I went, oh, shit. Because I didn't want to be sidetracked by getting into discussion about what she did. I didn't really want to talk about what she did. And in the book, I hardly talk about it. It was very, very little bit of the book. And the ironic part of it, there were people who were at that conference who really, really would have liked to tear her head off, because they brushed up against her in the, I guess it was early 70s when all these problems were happening with Leary and the capture and the extradition from Afghanistan and so forth and so on, and leading to his being in jail and Joanna kind of cutting a swath of terror through the support community for Leary, including Ginsburg and people on the left. Remember, you know, he was free from jail with the help of the Weather Underground. You know, so it was all Black Panthers he was hanging around with at some period after he got out of jail, and that was difficult, that situation. But so a lot of weird things were going on, and she burned people. I mean, she turned state evidence. She became an informant.
And then didn't she kind of go underground? And when she reappeared in Basel, wasn't like her coming out party from being?
Well, I think she was sort of going out there. This is kind of her. I don't want to get into a thing with her about her, but too much. You know, but she definitely, I think, she wanted to be exonerated and accepted by this community of LSD entheogen takers, worshippers, whatever, people who've been affected by it enough to gather in Basel, 2,000 or 3,000 strong, whatever we were that weekend. So I didn't want my reaction to Joanna Leary was to try to I didn't want to engage her very much. There were other people who would have spoken from firsthand experience about what she did, how it affected them in terms of working with the cops or the narcs or the FBI, whatever she was doing. They had personal experience of being burned by her. I didn't have personal experience being burned. I'm a writer writing about something, and I just wanted to steer clear of it, so I just tried to kind of like mollify her a little bit and try to get back to another question, please, because it's why get into all that?
Did you speak to her later on or anything?
A little bit. I tried, but she it was a little bit weird.
Weird. Yes. Nobody liked her.
I asked her to come up and talk to me afterwards.
Right, that's what you said, yeah.
Yeah, and was just trying to play, because I thought it was like public therapy that was going on.
Absolutely.
And I was not willingly into the role of a public therapist, and I didn't really, my role was as a speaker, as a social historian, as a journalist, as an activist, as whatever.
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head by saying that she was looking for some type of public therapy and reacceptance into the community, but I'll tell you what, I didn't find anybody for the remainder of that conference that had anything really nice to say about her.
No, very presumptuous. She came in and kind of insinuated herself and come up on the stage and doing all these things.
It was the buzz. It was the buzz. Yeah. After your presentation, that was all anybody, within an hour, that was all over the place that she had resurfaced.
I could have handled it differently and been really hard on her, but I just didn't. Maybe it was the jet lag, or I wasn't in the mood.
You did it perfect. You were very cool, and you may have blinked, but I didn't see it from where I was sitting. And you handled her very coolly and said, "Come up and talk to me about this later," and just played her off, which I thought was excellent. And that's what I related to you when I finally got caught up with you after your deal.
That was very cool. If I could, I actually have to leave pretty soon. We can come back and talk again sometime. But I want to just make a brief comment, if I might, about that conference. What I thought was really, a lot of amazing things happened at that conference in Basel in January 1966, Hoffman's 100th birthday. What a privilege to be there. But I was struck with certain things that happened. And I have a very vivid memory of Hoffman at one point being on the stage, behind a podium, or maybe he might have been standing without his walker.
At the final ceremony.
He was on stage at various times.
Right, he was.
But certainly at the final, but there was at one point, it might have been the final ceremony, where he at one point looked to this audience, and I remember being behind him at this point, on the point because they had many different speakers up there, but he was the keynote, obviously. And he kind of put his arms out as if to embrace the crowd.
Right.
And he said, "When I look at you," I think I'm saying exactly right, it's a close paraphrase. "When I look at you today, I say that LSD was not my problem child, but my prodigy."
That's right. That's almost word for word. And that was
What a beautiful thing to say. And that, I don't know that that was reported anywhere, but to me, that was the quintessential moment. Because the odd thing about dealing with sort of the older generation, not the 60s generation, but the folks like Hoffman or some of his peers, some of the old-time researchers from the 50s, from Czechoslovakia, from the United States, from other countries. There's this sort of a strange pretext, or pretense, I should say, that somehow the scientific research is good, and I certainly support it, and that's okay, but when it got out on the street, you can't really say that's good because, we were trying to get the scientific research back, and I think that that's a kind of a false distinction, and I think Hoffman, in that gesture, in that comment, obliterated that notion, that somehow the people that turned on through street acid were doing something wrong, something whatever, something that's not, something that was taboo, something that's still taboo, something that wasn't quite kosher as compared to the legitimate scientific research that was going on until Timothy Leary screwed everything up again, which is not how I feel.
Right.
But you know, that's sort of the one of the narratives that's going on around here, or what's even going on at the conference. Not the only narrative.
No.
And I think it's in a way a false narrative. And I was very, very heartened by Dr. Hoffman's comment. I thought, well, what a beautiful thing to say, talking to an audience of several thousand of people with, you know, rasta hair, dreadlock of 8 different color hair.
And I saw kids.
And people with suit and ties as well. It was a real mix.
And little
mixture.
Kids, old people.
Obviously hippie veterans and newbies, you know, the whole panoply, from people from Australia, Japan, Africa, Italy, you know, everywhere.
But I believe that was at the closing ceremony when he reached out. And if you recall, I mean, it's just burned into my memory. People were standing and applauding. He was like an aura around Albert. And all of a sudden, the entire crowd broke out a cappella to sing Happy Birthday.
Yeah, it might have been the sugar. I think I was so stunned and blown away by what he said.
Yeah.
I might not have been noticing anything that happened for a few minutes after. You know? But I it was a wonderful event, And you know, not more we could say about it. Let's pick it up on another conversation. I've enjoyed speaking.
Well, this has been wonderful for me to get back with you, Martin, and I'm sure all my listeners are going to enjoy this as well. And I want to thank you again for taking the time to speak with us. We're about an hour and 20 minutes, which seemed to have gone by very quickly. But I want to thank you for joining me in the Opium Den, and I'll take you up on that offer to call you again, because I'm sure that people are going to really enjoy hearing what you have to say.
Very good. Happy 420, day late.
Okay.
Take care.
One quick question, Martin.
Sure.
You still do LSD?
Oh, no, I haven't taken LSD for a long time. Nor do I really... it's not that I mind talking about my experiences, but I generally don't. It's my own experiences. Very, very important to me. Very important to me. But I never took it a lot. It didn't strike me as something that I wanted to do a lot. So it was very special. And it's been spring equinox, 1960 was the last day I took it.
1960?
No, excuse me, 1980. I'm sorry.
Okay.
1980.
Well, I intentionally left this to our last question. I wanted to give my sign off before I asked you, and I'll cut this out of the interview. I was just from.
Oh no, I don't care. I don't care one way. I don't mind people asking. It's not what I wrote about. I like to talk about. There's lots of things one can talk about LSD, and I have my own take on what it did for me, but it's very personal.
Yeah.
It's very transpersonal. Anyway, take it easy.
Okay, Martin, right. I'll talk to you later. Thanks again.
Bye.
Bye now. That was Martin Lee, author of Acid Dreams, and a very nice fellow. We hope you enjoy this, and tell your friends. Thanks a lot.